With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
Is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
The tragic Charlie Kirk shooting wasn't a heat-of-the-moment crime. This was, according to prosecutors, a deliberate act. A long gun, a rooftop, a public figure in a crowded venue. And behind it all, if the state's allegations are correct, a handwritten note, a digital trail, and more than a week of planning. Tyler James Robinson is now facing the death penalty for the killing of Charlie Kirk. The prosecution is calling it political targeting, but here's the part that matters most right now. Why does someone get to that point? Not just what they did, but how they got there. What turns a grievance into a mission? What transforms an ideology into a kill shot? And more urgently, how do we spot the warning signs before the trigger's ever pulled? Can we? Joining us, psychotherapist, forensic behavior expert, and author of many books. I'm looking around my desk right now. Here we go. I'm going to grab this one right here. The Minds of Mass Killers, probably most applicable to this conversation. Siobhan Scott here to help us break down the psychology of targeted violence, obsession, leakage, and the quiet cues the rest of us keep missing. Let's talk about this one a bit, because there was leakage, if you will. He did talk about this a bit in ways, shapes, and forms. Let's start with what prosecutors are alleging: that written note, the text messages, the claim for over a week of planning. From a clinical standpoint, how does someone psychologically move from just a grievance into violent intent in like 7 days with no history of doing this in the past?
My guess is he had actually been thinking about it for a lot longer than 7 days. But maybe the plan, when he set the location up, you know, the plan was probably seven mm-hmm. days. But this is not something that just comes out of the blue. Killings really almost never come out of the blue, unless you're talking about a road rage situation or something like that. So I put this in the category of an ideological assassination. I don't think he was overtly political, not just driven by that. Mm-hmm. But I think he saw Charlie, and there will be differences of opinion on this. I really know sure. the two sides. He saw Charlie as causing harm. And I think he developed a sense of moral righteousness that he would be like a soldier doing the right thing by killing him. And I have to say, quite frankly, there is alarming buzz. I spend a lot of time on social media, all over social media on the right and the left, of people who have become so polarized, they make jokes about killing people on the other side. And how many times do they start fixating on that and really come up with plans? Because in truth, we are living in a war zone in the United States right now. I'm an old person. relatively speaking. And I have never seen, I lived through the 60s. I was a little kid, but, you know, I remember how contentious everything was. I have never seen the talk of violence, the calls for war, the calls for succession of states. You know, we just want to break off from the U.S. I see this psychologically. There may not be bullets flying everywhere, but there are more bullets flying and people calling for civil war. And I think we're just in a very dangerous, you know, psychic place in this country. And it's a culture war of ideas. And I think that is feeding this. We had the assassination of Melissa Hortman from Minnesota, the legislator there, and her husband and their dog.
And the dog.
A few months ago. I think we're going to be seeing more and more of these kind of things happen until we can turn the heat down in this country, if we can turn the heat down in this country.
And that's a big question. I mean, the moral righteousness, that's what seems to be the justification that people who go this far stand behind. They believe they're doing something greater. They're doing something bigger. It's for a bigger, better cause. But is someone like this, do you think he thought about his future at all? What was going through this guy's mind? Was he thinking, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm going to get away with it? Or am I going to be a hero and I'm going to somehow jury nullification is going to save me? Like we hear that word being thrown around with the assassination of the United Healthcare CEO and Luigi Mangione. What the hell? I mean, I get people having their moral righteous standpoints, and it's not super healthy no matter what side you're on, but to act and to do something like this with no seeming regard or is it ignorance of what the repercussions would be for you if you in fact go as far as this guy did?
You know, I view this as a part of the adolescent brain, because up to age 25, you've still got an adolescent kind of brain. Yeah, most parts of your brain are fully developed, except for your prefrontal cortex, which makes you logical, which makes you think ahead, which makes you think about consequences. And the 18 to 24-year-olds commit a very large percentage of crime in this country and everywhere. And it's because they're impulsive and they don't think things through. They don't think about consequences. That's why car insurance rates are so much higher for teenage boys. There are 23% of the arrests in the country are males between 18 to 24 years old. Mm-hmm. And that says something about the way their brains function. You know, they're not necessarily thinking consequences through very well.
You know, and we talk about that a lot, where obviously that's physiology. That's something that we can't control the rate at which we develop. But can we control the rate at which we want to exercise it with younger people? Are we not doing enough of that? Are we doing too much of, well, it's not developed, so they're not going to do it? There's a lot of people who, you know, can clearly look a little bit down the road at that age and not make horrible choices. Is that something that some just develop faster and then they have this ability? Are there some that literally it ain't there? It's just not there yet, so they can't make it, and there's no exercising it, and there's no teaching it, and there's no way of getting that moving and those connections happening faster than which their body will allow it to?
Yeah, I think most people who are well parented do better than those who aren't. But in all indications that we have at this point, he came from a nice family. He was well parented, so it's tricky, because to what extent is it maturation? And then we should throw in, there are some people whose brains never develop really well, and so they stay impulsive, you know, going into their adult years, and that's just sort of their lifelong pattern. It's very tricky. Again, I look at culture. We've got a gun-saturated culture, because you look at every country in the world, And you've got the same brains. You've got impulsive adolescence. I mean, that's just part of the human condition. But you don't see everybody picking up guns because there aren't guns everywhere.
I was going to ask that. So you have thousands of outraged people on both sides, thousands upon thousands. But then there are these, what, grievance collectors? Is that, I think I read that somewhere.
Robin says wound collectors.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Similar in thought. That is there a catalyst? Is there something that pushes these people? Because, boy, I'm outraged by a lot of different things I see in today's world, and I'm not going to go into great detail, but I haven't acted. You know, I do what I can, but I'm not going to go bear arms and head to the streets. So what happens in these people's minds that they go, well, it's me or nobody. I'm going to go do this.
Yeah.
What is that?
You are not an adolescent boy, you know,
thank God,
who plays lots of violent video games and has a lot of guns in the house. And, you know, you're just a very different person. I don't
but
even
I
go
do
there
have
either.
Guns. That's the difference. And we've joked on this show that I've got like six big knives located in my apartment, and
which
I have
is not healthy
handguns.
And should not be encouraged.
But I'm stable, and I understand when to use these things, and I know there's a lot going on in our world, but I don't feel the need to go grab my guns and head to the streets.
But that's your well-functioning prefrontal cortex. You're an intelligent woman. You're a mature woman. You can look ahead. And yes, somebody's mentioning hormones. That has testosterone. I'm sorry. Right. Men commit 90% of violent crime.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm in menopause, so I could be outrageous as well.
We're not going to plant that seed.
I know.
But in my book, I use the term injustice collectors. And this is really a bit different than I think the perpetrator in the case we're talking about, because that fits mass shooters. And I just want to emphasize that a targeted, ideologically driven assassination is very different from somebody that goes out and tries to kill all the kids in the school or all the Jewish people in the synagogue or all the Black people in the market or the church. Those are folks who are driven with some really dark personality forces. They tend to be psychopathic, narcissistic, paranoid, and they see everything that goes wrong in their lives as this other group of people doing something to them. They tend to gamify this, so they follow each other online. They want to get higher kill scores than the other mass killers. It's got a really specific psychology, and that's really what my book is about. And so an ideologically driven assassin is very different because usually it's one issue and something that they feel this strong, you know, this person is doing so much harm, they start fantasizing about the world would be a better place. And we're seeing so much of that. And so you just get this combination of, you know, the person is distraught about it, they've been thinking about it, and then there's an opportunity and they're good with guns and they've got access to a gun and they're a young male with an adolescent brain. And, you know, I think we're at risk for this. And then we've got the copycat thing, because we talked about that a few weeks ago, when you have one event like this, other people, it's like they're primed. It's like, hey, I could pull this off. I could do it. I could get away with it. And that sets the stage. And so everyone that happens tends to set off more.
The alleged note said, I had the opportunity to take out Charlie Kirk and I'm going to take it. What a simple note. I mean, what kind of language do you hear in that phrasing? And what does it tell you about the mindset or role identity that's going on here? I think when we think of something like this, we're expecting some manifesto that is ideological and this or that. This is just like, well, the McRib's back. I'm going to go pick one of those up. I mean, it's just so callous.
I think it shows, again, that adolescent, simplistic kind of black and white. Here's an opportunity. I think this guy is spreading hate. He's doing bad things. Obviously, he was invested in his partner, who is reported to be trans. I think there's some probably pretty good evidence of that. Mm-hmm. And so this felt personal to him. And in his mind, it was sort of like a surgical strike, sort of like a soldier who goes into battle. And it's like, there's the enemy, and it is just my job to take him out. And he saw it in a very black and white way.
I mean, it seems he was kind of taking on the role in his delusions of a savior.
Very much the way you're describing it.
I mean, can you speak to the psychology behind role adoption and what pushes someone into that frame where they feel like, okay, if I don't do this, no one's going to do this. I must be the one that's called at this moment in time. I mean, what's going on in that mind that someone thinks, well, I'm the chosen one. I know he didn't use those sort of words, but you almost have to think in the back of his mind, he must be thinking something like that if he's going to go and take out or go and do something like this.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit. I would not say there's any evidence that he has mental illness or a personality disorder, unlike mass killers who do have either they're psychotic about 20% of the time, or they've got those personality traits, which really put them in the personality disorder category. I think in this case, it's just this sense of moral righteousness. I can make a difference here, and having the means, and yeah, a little bit of narcissistic thinking of, look, I'm going to do something really important.
Mm-hmm. You know, everybody, I'm sure, in his circle, his family, friends, anybody who interacted with him, they all are looking back and they're going, well, were there any signs? If there were signs, you know, were they missed or could they even be acted on? If somebody's of signaling or leaking out some of their feelings. I mean, you go to any gathering of human beings right now, and if the topic turns political, you're going to have some over here and some over there and some right here. And just because someone is disagreeing with you doesn't mean that they're going to go and do something like this. From a lot of accounts, you know, he did express his distaste with Charlie Kirk. A lot of people have done that.
Yeah.
And there's only one that acted this way out of the gazillions that weren't fans of Charlie Kirk. Mm-hmm. So how does someone who's an observer, who's a family member, a friend, someone around this guy, and I'm not just speaking of this case alone, but in general, the world we're in right now, how does anyone know what is a signal from someone that is truly a signal of alarm versus they have a difference of opinion?
This is a really hard one in this case because he was described as quiet, intelligent. His friends in the gaming world on Discord found him very affable. Mm-hmm. He was not doing a lot of ranting about violence. And for the mass killers who've really got the personality disorders, often there's months or even years of leakage where they're writing about murder, where, you know, if they're in the psychopathic category, they have a history of violence. They've killed animals as children. The Parkland mass killer actually would kill animals and then bring the dead animals to school. Excuse me, not a way to make friends.
That's really an interesting show and tell item now, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Wait a second. Sitting here, I'm smack dab in the middle of Wisconsin. We are heading into deer hunting season. We might even be there. I know we're duck hunting season. I was out kayaking like 2 weeks ago and they were out on the lake shooting. We're like paddling, like, get the hell out of here. But it's a big deal around here. It wouldn't be anything weird to kill a deer and bring it to school.
There's a difference between deer hunting and, you know, going and killing small animals around your yard for fun.
Yeah, it was small animals. And he would bring them to school to upset the girls. And I mean, just look what I did. And mutilating them. And yeah, and so there are cases where the Sandy Hook killer, as of third grade, fifth grade, he was writing stories in school about murder. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like leakage, leakage, leakage. Sometimes they've posted, the Santa Barbara killer posted videos online that were really rather horrific. And, you know, so people, and sometimes, you know, they'll pose with their guns. trends in social media and make statements. You know, I am going to be the next school shooter. I mean, there has been dramatic cases where leakage was missed. So in this case, I'm not seeing that there were these warning signs.
Yeah. And I, maybe there were, maybe there weren't. We don't know of them yet, at least. But in cases like you just cited, okay, leakage. They brought the animal, the dead animals to school. They were writing disturbing stories. None of those are crimes. Right. Unfortunately, I don't know, depending how you look on it. There's nothing you can really do. You can't lock somebody up for those sort of things. And especially if they're kids. So I think that's where so many people, and there's so many families and parents, or just concerned adults who know somebody's kid that is acting, you know, concerning. Okay. Sign, see something. Everybody's talking amongst themselves now. It's the do something part. Do something. I don't know if we always equate do something as law enforcement's going to step in and save the day. That's not the reality here, because there's laws that really don't allow them to do much if no crime's been committed. So it's that do something part that seems to be missing. But what are we missing in society? We're seeing something. We're saying something. What needs to be done that's not being done?
Oh, get, you know, if parents are made aware of these kind of things, stories, internet posts, Facebook, things like that, get the kid to a good therapist who specializes in adolescents and children. I close the book, the Mass Killers book, with a story of a kid that had made a threat, teenage boy, and came to therapy. And it was a pretty credible threat, other than there were no guns in the house. I think if there had been guns in the house, he might have acted on the threat. Mm-hmm. But he came to therapy. And so I sort of go through that story and how I worked with him. And he ended up taking a very different direction in life and ended up having a good life. So that's one thing. But are there other things? Yes, because maybe the family doesn't have resources. Maybe they live in a community where there, you know, aren't good options for therapy. So what we really need, and this is recommended, you know, by all the experts, are intervention teams that are made up of a person or people from law enforcement, a therapist, and people from the school. And so if somebody sees something, let's say one kid says, hey, he was talking at lunch about, you know, bringing a gun and blowing people away. You need to report that to the administrators of the school, and then they need an evaluation by a team who goes out into the home, who talks with the family, who talks about what kind of access to weapons do they have. And he may need all kinds of intervention services, or they may determine that it was an empty threat, but they're going to monitor him closely. And there aren't very many places where we have teams like that. And so that's another recommendation I make. We need really good intervention teams, and it's worth it.
Siobhan, when a troubled teen sits down in front of you for therapy and you see them having made some threats, they're angry at society, they don't fit in school, so they're claiming they're going to go do something. Where do you begin? And I don't want to derail the conversation away from what we were talking about, but what is your first step in, you need to see what's going on in this kid's mind?
You've got to build that therapeutic alliance with them and connect with them, really let them. I mean, this is in-depth therapy. It's not like a quick talk with the school counselor. You know, you've got to spend a lot of time with them, find out about what's good in their lives, what's not so good in their lives. And obviously, there's usually a laundry list of things that are not going well in their lives. So you want to help them know that you are on their side, you're rooting for them, you understand. And, you know, this is pretty in-depth stuff, because number one, they may not want to be there. So you have to very, in the beginning, validate, yeah, it sucks to have to go talk to somebody like me when you don't really want to do that. And usually once you start validating that, they start to trust you. And sometimes it's just like the floodgates open and you help relieve some of that pressure. And then you, I mean, are they really pissed off at their parents? And so you may have the parents come in for a separate session and talk about, you know, how are you coping with the stress at home? And maybe you can give the parents some other ways of interacting that are going to be more effective and work better. And then you want to help the kid find hope. Sometimes in the case I mentioned in the book, they need to be in a different school. You know, there are schools that are smaller. We had an option for high school in the, even though it was a small community I lived in, it was for kids who had special emotional needs. And so the staff, it was a very, very good staff to student ratio. The staff were all trained in counseling techniques. They got a lot of attention and they really focused on let's work with their strengths. You've got to help kids like that find hope. And so I'm a real believer that intervention with good therapy with somebody who can work with kids like that, that saves lives. And we'll never know how many lives are saved because somebody got their kid connected with a good therapist.
And that's, you know, lovely. And I completely 1,000% agree. But what about the large chunk of them that are going to be coming from homes that the parents are unaware for whatever reason? They're too busy. They don't care. They're in their own world. They're like their kids. And, you know, saying there's something wrong with my kid is a direct insult on them. So we don't want to raise any sort of suspicion or any questioning of the children's mindset or behavior because they're fearful that it's going to negatively impact them. What do you do when you're the parent and your kid's telling you about somebody else at school that's doing something a bit weird and off and it's reported, but therapy's not required? You can't mandate, you can't make therapy mandatory, at least not right now. And these things just kind of fester. And, you know, well, you can't, like, you don't want to pull your kid out of school. I mean, unless the threat's like, something's going to happen tomorrow or something of that nature, but you just, it lingers. And then we all just, as the rest of society, have to put up with every horrible parent's poor decision-making for little Jimmy that they can't admit has some problems and needs some help, but is not getting that help.
And another thing that happens, I last time I looked at data, it was only 30% of the schools had an embedded mental health counselor, not just an academic counselor, but a mental health counselor in school. And sometimes you can get kids care that way. Of course, yeah. My bias is we need an embedded mental health counselor in every school.
In every classroom. I mean, because the reality is, okay, great, you have one in your school for how many hundreds of children?
Right. Right. Yeah. And we're talking now in the government of pulling all mental health people out of school, right? Kids don't need that. They just need the Ten Commandments written on the wall in the classroom.
And every kid deserves a Smith and Wesson at their desk.
Right. You know? Yeah. Right. And, you know, bottom line, if let's say my kid comes home and said, you know, Josh at school says he's got a gun and in the next 3 days he's going to come and take it out on, you know, Mrs. Jones' math class, yeah, or something. 1-800 call FBI. Yeah. I mean, make that call.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.